Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Dennis Walker. I'm counsel for the plaintiff, Sherry Timm. She's the appellant. We're here because Prudential Insurance failed to follow the law and failed to follow a federal court order requiring the payment of long-term disability benefits. Sherry Timm was a Panasonic employee. She worked as a sales representative. She was successful in this position. She had a large territory, and her work required vigorous physical and mental demands and requirements. Starting in November of 2002, over 8.5 years ago apparently, she began a medical leave because she became totally disabled. Her disability entitles her under the Prudential Insurance policy to be paid 2/3 of her former salary, less offsets for Social Security benefits. This is a long-term disability benefits case, but this is the second litigation made necessary by the non-payment of benefits in this case. I have written down two dates on the board here, September 6, 2007 and June 1, 2009. Those are the critical times that I would like to ask your attention to. On September 6, 2007, U.S. District Court Judge Marcia Krieger entered an order in favor of Sherry Timm requiring Prudential to pay benefits. Judge Krieger determined that Sherry Timm is disabled, has been disabled under the terms of the Prudential policy, a policy that was dealt with as a plan under ERISA. Judge Krieger specifically found that she was entitled to the payment of LTD or long-term disability benefits. The second date that I've written down here, which is at the bottom of the chart, is June 1, 2009. That's the date that Sherry Timm filed this action in the Denver District Court. And the reason for the filing of the second action is because Prudential did nothing for 21 months following the federal court order. Sherry Timm demanded month after month that Prudential pay benefits, determine the amount and duration of benefits, but Prudential did nothing. Unfortunately, if we go back to September 6, 2007, when Judge Krieger decided that Sherry Timm prevailed and reversed Prudential's decisions under ERISA, she also declined to retain any further jurisdiction whatsoever. She found that the mechanical determination of the amount and duration of benefits could be determined by the parties, and that Prudential had further decisions to make. Quite naturally, Sherry Timm, through counsel, asked Judge Krieger not to do that. She essentially begged Judge Krieger, please retain jurisdiction. You already have this many hundreds of pages of administrative record. Please determine the amount and duration of benefits. This has been in front of Prudential for several years. In a ruling in February 2008, Judge Krieger said, I could do that, but I don't have to do that. I declined to do that because I would be entering the realm of becoming a super plan administrator if I made such a decision, and I declined to do that. She specifically said in her order of September 6, 2007, as well as the order of February 2008, that the court would not entertain any further jurisdiction in the matter about Sherry Timm's dissatisfaction or possible dissatisfaction with the determination by Prudential.
Walker, do you understand that to preclude you from bringing another action in federal court?
No. It did not preclude any action, whether state or federal. In fact, it specifically leaves the door open for a second action. And if Prudential didn't do what it was supposed to do, made necessary a second action. Because as the case law makes clear, such a determination under ERISA is not a final judgment, because it leaves open the question of the amount, and because the court did not entertain and precluded the entertainment of further jurisdiction, nothing could come back before the federal court by way of dissatisfaction with what Prudential might do. So what happened then, and over the next 21 months, this time gap in these two dates, is that Sherry Timm sought from Prudential the payment of benefits and the determination and decision-making that was required. Multiple requests were made, additional evidence of ongoing disability medical evidence, medical reports were supplied to Prudential. This is all very clearly laid out in the complaint filed on the bottom date here, June 1, 2009. Prudential has never answered this lawsuit. Prudential filed a motion to dismiss. In between these two dates, Colorado insurance law changed. For the first time, Colorado enacted a statute dealing with ERISA-type benefits when the subject of an insurance policy. And this new law was passed August 5, 2008, and it's covered in the briefs. That new law created for the first time requirements for Colorado insurance that such insurance should not reserve discretion to the insurance company, that such insurance should not deny de novo review on judicial review, and that such insurance should be subject to the obligation, if unreasonable delay and unreasonable denial took place, the person who was deprived of benefits lawfully should be entitled to recover legal expenses plus two times benefits.
Two times benefits is something greater than you could get under ERISA, correct?
It is not specifically allowed in ERISA at all.
Why isn't the principle of conflict preemption then applicable, because this tries to do something that ERISA does not allow?
I would submit that in this case, we don't have to reach the issue of conflict preemption in theory. We're dealing with the inapplicability of conflict preemption as applied. Here, because of the order from the federal court in September of 2007, we have a clear indication that the federal court did what ERISA allows. Judge Krieger reviewed the benefits determination. She reversed Prudential. She required Prudential to make a further decision. When Prudential failed to act, that left Sherry Tim with no choice but to file further action, either in state or federal court, because federal jurisdiction is not exclusive for claims for benefits.
Once you've started in federal court, don't you think you need to stay in federal court?
Because the federal action was closed and the federal court expressly declined further jurisdiction.
Well, there's a difference between saying I'm going to keep jurisdiction in this case open and you come back whenever you want it, as opposed to after the administrators have made their decision, come back and ask for a review again.
A second case could have been filed in either state court or federal court, but the federal court order precluded any further remedy in the earlier first case. And the Denver District Court apparently misunderstood this, and I would submit terribly so, by suggesting that Sherry Tim's benefits claim is inextricably intertwined with a federal litigation. The state court judge in Denver District Court actually put a footnote in the order of dismissal saying that Sherry Tim could go back to federal court in that action, seeking further relief and maybe appeal to the 10th Circuit. The 10th Circuit has made clear, and other circuits have made clear, that there is no appeal from a non-final judgment. There is no interlocutory appeal allowed. And so she had one choice, bring another action. She could have sued in state or federal court. She filed in Denver District Court. Prudential chose not to remove the action to federal court. But that doesn't mean, as Judge Hyatt found in this case, that federal court is an exclusive forum. Federal courts do not have exclusive jurisdiction over benefits claims. But back to the question of conflict preemption, I would submit that as applied, Colorado's new insurance law allows specifically what's requested in the second claim in this case, because it does not create any legal remedy that is incompatible with the federal relief allowed by 29 U.S.C. Section 1132, which is the federal ERISA remedial statute, sometimes referred to in the ERISA case law as the remedial scheme, sometimes in dicta referred to as an exclusive remedial scheme. But I would submit that the entire philosophy and legal precedent dealing with conflict preemption, which stems from a 1941 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Hines versus Davidovitz, is the notion that a federal law, when dealing with a particular subject matter, should preempt a state law that is incompatible with or stands as an obstacle to the pursuit or remedies under the federal law. That is not happening here. Nothing requested in this case in Denver District Court is an obstacle to what ERISA allows for. And that's why the potential for conflict preemption, a matter that the U.S. Supreme Court in the Rush Prudential versus Moran decision said has never been addressed in the U.S. Supreme Court, and so it's dicta, where the U.S. Supreme Court said we have anticipated such a collision between state law and federal law, and we have suggested that if such a collision occurs, state law might have to give way, but they haven't addressed it yet.
Are there any lower federal court decisions enforcing a law with, you know, double damages as penalties like the Colorado statute?
Not yet. We have now about 12 jurisdictions, such as Illinois, that have done the same thing as Colorado, where they have barred discretion from insured plans and barred the prohibition against de novo review. We don't have yet a decision in lower courts or circuit decisions that specifically say an additional remedy or one that helps with congressional intent with regard to ERISA is barred or allowed. We don't have that yet. There is a Ninth Circuit decision, fairly recent decision, I think it's cited in the briefs, and it suggests that ERISA's exclusive remedial scheme should be viewed to bar a state remedy that allows for additional relief. If that were ultimately held to be the case, that would not bar Sherry Tim's first claim for relief in this case. Sherry Tim's first claim for relief in this case is for the right to benefits under the policy under ERISA. The two times benefits.
But if we follow the Ninth Circuit, then the two times benefit part of the claim would be gone.
Right. Okay. And this is complicated. The courts have said that this is a very tricky area or difficult thicket, ERISA preemption. But a recent decision cited by the defense in their supplemental authorities by Judge Christine Arguello has observed that this statute might be preempted because it does not regulate insurance. An earlier decision by Judge Arguello, dealing with the same statute but a different subsection, led her to conclude that because the law, the Colorado insurance law, allows for a bar against discretion, then more benefits will likely be paid out by insurance companies. And if more benefits are paid out by insurance companies, then that affects the risk pooling arrangement, which is a criteria under federal law for dealing with whether it governs or regulates insurance. In Judge Arguello's more recent decision from this spring, she said the opposite, but didn't address the same question she addressed in Cohut, which was the potential for the payment of more money. I would submit that Colorado's law, which calls for the payment of two times benefits in the event of unreasonable delay and denials, calls for the insurer to pay more in benefits and therefore unequivocally affects the risk pooling arrangement. But that sort of dodges the main question you asked Judge Casebolt, which is, what about conflict preemption? I'm responding back on the question of the savings clause, which is ERISA's federal law, which expresses congressional intent that laws regulating the business of insurance are saved from preemption.
What do you do with the Davila case that specifically says if there's a conflict, it doesn't matter whether there's a savings clause involved? If there is indeed conflict between the two, we don't even get to the savings clause issue.
And here, arguably, there's no conflict if you look at as applied, because we've already been to federal court with a successful journey there. Now we have a question. Does this second lawsuit potentially invoke a remedy as applied that would conflict with ERISA? Here it cannot, because it is the conflict only comes up when it conflicts with the federal purpose of both protecting the right to benefits as balanced against the federal purpose of encourage or incentivizing the initiation of plans by employers. I see that my time is running close. I would like to reserve a little time, but I may not have any, if I may. Unless there are questions.
We'll give you 8 seconds.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please this court. On behalf of Appellee Prudential Insurance Company of America, I'm Franz Hardy, registration number 32286, and with me at council table is Lance Reen, registration number 38989. There are three germane issues for this appeal. One, it's been discussed at length, ERISA preemption. Two, the application of res judicata. And three, the issue of ripeness. Briefly, as to the first issue, ERISA preemption applies to bar any claim under the state statute. As already discussed by Mr. Walker, we have a standard that's not found under ERISA, the unreasonable delay or denial of benefits and the allowance of attorney's fees, court costs, and two times the covered benefit. As mentioned, the brand new case of Flowers versus Life Insurance of North America, which was just issued month before last on March 15, 2011, and referenced in our supplemental authorities filed with this court on April 20, 2011, is consistent with the 10th Circuit decisions in Kidney and Kelly, which bar bad faith claims as being preempted by ERISA. The provision, the state statute here, does not fall within the state savings clause. It's directly preempted as opposed to conflict preemption. There's both. It's not only preempted, but it does not fall within the savings clause because it does not bear on who gets into the risk pool, risk sharing pool for insurance, or prescribe conditions under which insurers must pay for assumed risks. It is not a law regulating insurance within the meaning of ERISA's savings clause.
So are we to tell the General Assembly that its express statement that this is a law regulating insurance should be totally disregarded?
As to those subsections, Judge Casebolt, yes. The Kidney case, where you have a bad faith claim that is trying to provide additional remedies beyond that provided for under ERISA, expressly found that it was preempted. So to the case here, as Judge Arguello articulated in Flowers, that you cannot give beyond what is allowed for under ERISA. That is preempted.
The argument that your opposing counsel is making is that as applied in this case, a remedy of two times benefits would not be inconsistent with ERISA in any way. How do you respond to that?
That is incorrect. And I think we only need to look back at the Kidney decision from the 10th Circuit, where they're applying a bad faith law that allows consequential damages and punitive damages, and them coming to the conclusion that it's preempted, and apply the same analysis to what the Colorado legislature is trying to do, which is apply two times the benefits, attorney's fees, and court costs under a standard of unreasonable delay or denial.
Not suggesting we're bound by the 10th Circuit's opinion, are you?
No, but I am suggesting that its analysis goes through the criteria necessary to go through ERISA preemption, and also that Judge Daly, that it distinguishes, I know it comes earlier in time, but it distinguishes the case or the analysis in Cohut McClenahan, which are the Colorado federal district court cases that are only addressing de novo review and not the two-time covered benefits standard. To move on to the second issue, res judicata. Res judicata applies to bar Ms. Tim from relitigating issues previously.
What issue was relitigated? This was 21 months of inaction. That had not been part of the earlier case, had it?
No. The part that cannot be relitigated, and that is discussed at length in the complaint, is actions or inaction that took place or conduct that took place during the preceding administrative process and up to Judge Krieger's ruling in that case.
Are they trying to relitigate that? Aren't they just relying upon the litigation in that earlier case? They're not trying to relitigate that. They're trying to use it as a jump off to say, where is the benefits?
If we're talking about action or inaction post Judge Krieger's order, we are not arguing that that is barred by res judicata. If you read the complaint, what is the basis for the long-term disability benefit claim at length is conduct in the prior administrative process.
For which she has not received any benefits despite Judge Krieger's order.
She has received benefits, Judge Daly.
According to the complaint, she had not.
That is correct, but she has in fact received 2 years of benefits.
This claim dismissed on a motion to dismiss? Was the complaint dismissed on a motion to dismiss?
Yes.
So I can't get into any fact finding, can I?
Yes, you can, in terms of the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Yes, this court need not, and the trial court need not, accept the allegations as the in the complaint as true. That's a third issue of ripeness, which is akin to subject matter jurisdiction. And what was required after Judge Krieger remanded the case back to Prudential is to go through the administrative process. And while Mr. Walker has provided two dates here, what has not been stated is that Prudential has tendered payment to Ms. Tim for 2 years of disability benefits. Prudential has made a determination as part of the administrative process not to provide additional benefits.
How can we look at the payment when subject matter jurisdiction is not before us? What's before us is the argument of claim preclusion, which we're dealing with here, and ripeness. Now, how is subject matter implicated in either one of those so that we can look outside the complaint itself?
Well, ripeness is akin to subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor, that the court does not have subject matter jurisdiction if a matter is not ripe for review.
So we're to apply two different standards of review here then? The first one being motion to dismiss, we have to accept the complaint's allegations as true, whereas ripeness, we apply a different standard?
Yes, and this court can do that under the difference between 12b1 and 12b5.
Was there any kind of indication in your motion to dismiss that you were proceeding under 12b1 as well as 12b5?
Your Honor, as I stand here, I don't recall. I know it was a motion to dismiss, but I don't recall the particulars of what rule I was proceeding under, to be honest with this court. But for purposes of ripeness and subject matter jurisdiction, it is appropriate to look beyond the mere allegations. To the extent that a plaintiff has raised a futility argument, that no decision has been made, and therefore proceeding with an administrative process that's not going anywhere, it was incumbent on Ms. Tim to provide that analysis in support of subject matter jurisdiction, which was lacking.
Didn't she do so by saying in the complaint that it's been 21 months and I've done everything I was supposed to do?
I think she said that it's been 21 months or payment has not been made. But I don't think that's akin to arguing or alleging futility for purposes of I don't have to exhaust the administrative process.
Well, what more would she have to allege? I mean, does she have to just wait indefinitely?
I think that the burden is on her to demonstrate subject matter jurisdiction and to make additional allegations or to attach items to her response to the motion to dismiss to say, and look, it's futile because I've sent in these records and they've done nothing to respond. But the fact of the matter is Prudential has responded. They've made payment. And what
did Prudential make, is it in the record before us that Prudential made payment?
Yes, it is in our reply in support of motion to dismiss.
Did you attach documents substantiating that, or is it a mere statement of counsel?
It is a mere statement of counsel. And that process is ongoing. So what we have is parallel actions moving at the same time. The administrative process under the plan subject to ERISA, is going on as we speak, as we also have a lawsuit proceeding in front of the state court and now an appeal. And what we need to do is allow that administrative process to become exhausted, because that's what ERISA seeks to streamline before we proceed with this case. So that, in essence, is both my, I've stepped ahead to the third argument, which is ripeness or subject matter jurisdiction.
We conclude that the plaintiff has adequately alleged futility. What happens then?
That's an interesting question, Judge Casebolt, because we have an administrative process that's ongoing.
Could on were we to reverse and remand, couldn't you move to stay the district court action pending completion of the administrative process and, you know, substantiate your motion with documentation as to what you claim has been ongoing?
That might be one avenue to pursue, or to dismiss the case and allow, instead of staying the case, waiting for a determination and allowing Ms. Tim to take whatever steps she deems necessary after exhausting the administrative process.
Mr. Hardy, I want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying on a particular issue. You are acknowledging that Ms. Tim can bring an action despite the federal court's judgment for further relief, are you not?
If and when she exhausts the administrative review process, only on conduct beyond Judge Krieger's order, not conduct prior to it, that would be barred by res judicata.
You also agree that subject to all these conditions, she could bring that action in state court?
I believe that there's concurrent jurisdiction for ERISA claims. Prudential could remove under federal question jurisdiction, but there's concurrent jurisdiction. Unless this panel has additional questions, in conclusion, ERISA preempts the state law claims. Any claim based on prior conduct prior to the federal court's determination is barred by res judicata. And finally, the trial court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because her claims are currently unripe. Based upon this, this court should affirm the trial court's decision in all respects. Thank you.
Walker, we'll give you one bite of the apple. Let's see how big a bite you can take here.
It's the ripeness versus res judicata conundrum. We can't get around that. The record shows nothing about the payment of benefits whatsoever, and it shows clearly the allegations that every step possible was taken to get Prudential to act before she filed suit. Futility was alleged. The word futility may not appear in the complaint. That's not what the law requires. She said it was impossible to get Prudential to do anything after 21 months of beating on Prudential. The subject matter jurisdiction argument has come up now for the first time.
That's raised in the ripeness issue. I think it's inherent in the ripeness issue.
Very well. We cited an additional case on ripeness, which deals with subject matter jurisdiction under federal law, and apparently would be dealt with the same way under state law, which is whether there's a true controversy or not.
And we're gonna ask you to conclude.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.